This episode of the Hatchcast is brought to you by Burgess Institute for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. The Burgess Institute empowers students to learn through action by providing programs, courses, and resources to foster an entrepreneurial mindset and create new ventures. One name, one program, Limitless U. Learn more at eship.msu.edu.
Welcome to
Creativity,
Risk-Taking,
Entrepreneurship,
Community,
Innovation,
Ambition.
This is
the Hatchcast.
Welcome back to the Hatchcast. I'm Brandon Weaver alongside
Aaron Richard
and Justice Keach.
Today we sat down with folks from Change Media Group. They discussed topics, something we were kind of new in. We haven't done before. We dived into the political space a little bit, their journeys in creating Change Media, and just what that media future looks like within the political space and how they can better reach us, the viewers.
Yeah, I think it was a very insightful view into something that, like Brandon said, we don't really talk about that much on the Hatchcast. But yeah, we thank you to them for coming in. Had a great conversation.
Ryan, Amanda, we really appreciate you both for taking the time to come in and be with us. It's kind of hard to ignore that we've got a few things happening. How are you guys holding up?
I'm well. Gabe is going to cut this.
Bless his biscuits.
Unless we talk about yoga, then he'll keep it. So if we talk about yoga and then we say we're
downward
doing good,
dog.
Now he'll keep it.
Guys, we really want to just, A, let you know that if you reach out to us on hatchcastpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Instagram @thehatchcast, we are super responsive and we would love to hear from you. And, you know, though we are socially distancing ourselves appropriately, we don't have to be distant from one another. I worked 4 weeks on that.
Thank you all for tuning in. We appreciate your viewership, or listenership, rather. And we'll see you next time on the Hatchcast.
Hi, everyone. It's Aaron Richard, co-creator and co-host of Hatchcast. Well, the last several days have been fairly remarkable. For many of us, this will be our first pandemic. Our daily lives have changed drastically. But like you, I hope, we're making the best of it. Now, on a little bit more serious note, on behalf of the entire MSU Burgess Institute team, we want you to know we are deeply committed to the health and safety of our students, our staff, the Spartan community, the community globally at large. Your health and safety is our paramount concern. Just to let you know as well, because this situation is evolving and it's dynamic and it's ever-changing, we at this moment as a full-time staff are working remotely. We are respecting the orders for all of us to remain socially distant so we can flatten the curve of COVID-19. We are urging everyone to stay healthy, to practice social distancing, and just to know that together, if we practice appropriate social distancing, we will be able to flatten the curve of this disease and really keep the most vulnerable people in our communities safe. If you are a student within launch or discovery programs, if you are a member of the Hatch, if you are a member of the East Lansing Technology Innovation Center, we are asking for all of you to move your meetings to a virtual platform. From the bottom of my heart, sincerely, the Burgess Institute for Entrepreneurship and Innovation, our team is here to support you. We will get through this together. If you have any questions, do not hesitate to reach out to us. Please make sure to bookmark and visit Michigan State University's latest updates on the coronavirus. Stay well and go green.
This episode of the Hatchcast is brought to you by the MSU Entrepreneurship Association. The MSUEA is a registered student organization open to all majors who are passionate about entrepreneurship. Find out more at msuea.org.
Today, I'm sitting down with good friends and MSU alums and local Love Lansing business owners.
So, Amanda Stitt, I'm the Chief Results Officer of Change Media Group, based here in Lansing. Correction, not a Spartan.
I apologize to my community.
Kalamazoo College. Good research. Thank you. Honorary, but.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Yes.
I'm Ryan Irvin. I'm the president at Change Media Group. That's enough of an intro for me.
Inc. Magazine said you are of the 500 fastest growing startups across the country. How does that feel? That feels really good, right?
That was huge. That was huge. We were in consideration to be in the 5,000. And so when they came back to us and said you are number 329 in America, that was pretty incredible.
So let's start from the very beginning. Why Change Media?
We were both sort of worked in a consulting and advising space. The digital advertising space specifically, there were not a ton of firms, very, very high markups, and the quality of the work that we saw and were receiving as clients was sort of not where we thought it should be. So we started Change Media Group with the goal of helping nonprofits, small businesses, and progressive organizations utilize digital and digital advertising in a way that could help them grow. And our sort of underlying goal was to do it in a way that could hopefully change the world in ways that were big and small. And over time, as our business has developed and our focus has changed slightly, we've sort of developed a creative element to our business. So now our business is very much focused on advertising and creative and trying to provide the absolute best services we can to our clients.
Who are your clients mostly?
They are primarily folks in the advocacy, nonprofit, government, and political campaign space. We generally think about it as people who are trying to change a policy or trying to improve some societal ill and trying to make the world a little better place.
You guys have done some bigger campaigns. I mean, it says you've helped with the Obama, Debbie Stabenow, Jennifer Granholm. What does it look like working with, you know, those campaigns and kind of crafting on your end?
Yeah, so Ryan and I met because of the Obama campaign, and that is one of the reasons why our name is Change Media Group. That's, you know, one of the things that brought us together. And, of course, that campaign was really, a pioneer in digital and really bringing that to the national stage in 2008. Those campaigns that I worked on, Senator Stabenow and Governor Granholm, I think those were exciting for a lot of reasons, but, you know, breaking glass ceilings of being the first woman U.S. Senator, first woman governor of Michigan were really exciting. And then all along the way, we were breaking ground with digital, like on the Stabenow campaign of 2000. I remember the day that we sent out our first weekly email and feeling like we were really ahead of the ballgame there. Ryan and I really pride ourselves in is how can we push the envelope and you know, keep people on the cutting edge of what is possible and what should be done to reach people. And in our very fragmented world of how people are consuming media and spending their time, that's what we think about all the time, is how do we get in front of people.
I agree with everything Amanda said. I think that presidential campaigns especially are, you know, they're fundamentally different in how they're covered and what you need to focus on as a campaign. But there are some, you know, tried and true principles that you apply across all campaigns. And so one of the things that over the last few years especially that has been something really important to us is focus. When you are really, really focused on the services you provide and doing it really, really well, that's the best way for you to help a client. And when you think about the size of larger campaigns, whether it's a ballot initiative like Voters Not Politicians that changed the gerrymandering rules here in Michigan, or it's a Senate campaign, or it's an independent expenditure super PAC, the ability to really stay focused on the thing you do and do well is how you can help the most. I would separate sort of all campaigns from presidential campaigns just because of the way they are covered. You know, the part of campaigns that we do with advertising, it's a big deal in all campaigns. But it is most of the ballgame in non-presidential campaigns. For presidential campaigns, they are covered wall-to-wall all day long on television and are talked about on social media all day long. So the nature of the communications challenges for those campaigns are much, much different.
Where do you guys see kind of media moving? Is there going to be something 5-10 years from now that in some way we consume our media different? Or what do you see as like the main platform moving forward, I guess?
It's a really difficult question. The pace of sort of fragmentation is still growing right now. When you look through the research and the trends, you know, TV is fairly stable but declining a little bit. You know, even radio is sort of all over the place with podcasts, with satellite radio, with traditional radio. And as you all have probably seen, thinking about entrepreneurship and new businesses, there are a whole host of new streaming services that have just been rolled out, some of them ad-based, some of them not. So I think that in the immediate next few years, what you'll see is a continued difficulty reaching people and a continued fragmentation of where people spend their time and where they're, you know, sort of getting content. For people who are constantly thinking about who is our audience, what's the message to that audience, and how do you reach them? There's no simple answer right now. We did a big campaign in Tennessee last year. It was TV and radio and streaming radio and social media ads and billboards and all these things, mail. All our target audience was surveyed afterward, and when people were asked where they remembered our message from, no one medium got more than 15% as the main medium that people remembered, you know. 15% of people remembered the online ads, 15% of people remembered the TV ads, 10% of people remembered the mail. I think that just speaks to the difficulty of, if you are a brand with an advertising budget, the way you think about how to reach people, it has to be nuanced because of where people are spending time, you know. Where is your target audience spending time? Are they spending time in one, consuming media in one place? And I think it's a really difficult challenge. I think on the Henier question, like, it's a really, really hard question.
Yeah, it could be some new app that pops up and everybody uses that, right?
I mean,
that
happens
funny,
every year.
Anecdote too to share on that was so Ryan and I are married and we have two children together, and Ryan asked our 2-year-old the other day, what do you want to do when you grow up? And his response was that he wanted to be on TV, but to think about, you know, what does being on TV for him look like when he, you know, in 20 years, like, it's very hard to know on what platform does that exist, what hologram.
I was just going to say that.
And whatnot. But I think the other direction of things, and for advertisers in the political space, but, you know, commercial, is this the future of direct response and how we are getting people to opt in, donate, take action, buy something so quickly and with such immediacy, and just kind of eliminating all the stickiness and barriers there. That's something that we spend a lot of time thinking about, and I think that's definitely the future of advertising, is just this idea of, you know, the passive brand advertising. Definitely there's always going to be a place for that, but how are you, you know, really breaking through and getting someone to immediately take action, do something, buy something.
I was just going to add, I think the last 5 years are an indication of how hard that question is too. 5, 6, 7 years ago, many, many, many companies were talking about virtual reality and augmented reality and how fast it was going to, like, change our lives and be in our lives. Amanda's point about reaching people and taking friction out of the transaction or the sign up has been a big area of growth, but, you know, augmented reality and virtual reality, yeah, they've really changed areas like gaming and things like that, but they haven't really fundamentally changed the way that most of us consume media.
How would you want it to shape?
I haven't thought about it a lot, because when I was talking about fragmentation, one of the questions we ask is, all right, where's the biggest place to reach people at a certain price? Where's the next? Where's the next? Where's the next? And because right now it's so far down on the list, like, we fundamentally just don't think a lot about it. I've definitely tried it and experienced it. It's a really interesting way to sort of view the world. But for me, I don't think a whole lot about it.
A few years ago, I was at a conference where a sort of up-and-coming scrappy media outlet was trying to leverage VR and surround video to tell the story about Aleppo. What was intriguing to me about that is that the camera was placed in a way that you saw all around you. You could experience the devastation all around you. And what their hope was is that it immediately emotionally connected you to the space, and that you realize that this isn't just something that's happening. Like, war and torn is not just a phrase. It is literal. It's very literal. And so I found that to be really kind of interesting.
To your point, there is a lot of potential for storytelling. I think that I have seen and looked into the specific rigs that they use for, like, that type of shooting. And I think it's like a lot of things. It's like having a computer in your pocket, right? It's only possible on a widespread basis when it's cheap enough.
Yep.
So that's probably what will be the tipping point for that, is first the cost and then the people with the ability to shoot in that way.
And the interesting thing too, I think, in terms of scale and how do you actually change hearts and minds, that's something we think about a lot. That image you know, of the child from Aleppo that, yes. you know, was so widely shared and impacted, like, you know, the cost now of being able to move people to action to see what's going on, you know, that probably was taken on an iPhone. Just the fact that it doesn't take much to move people. And so we spend a lot of time, though, with creative testing for our messages with video content, you know, that sometimes it's the piece of news coverage. Like, people are not watching conventional news. And like NBC Nightly News, right. you know, has kind of fallen off. But when people do see it, when it is put in front of them, it is very legitimate. And so testing, like, does that move someone more, or does the organic selfie video of someone telling their story? So that's something that we look at a lot, and often like the cost.
And that varies, yeah. right?
Mm-hmm. It does, that, all over the place.
Speaking of like what is down the road for 5 years, I want to know what scares the hell out of you in terms of media that's right here and now and very much in the present.
I think there's two ways to answer the question. One is competitively for us as a business, and the other is just sort of like for the media landscape in the world at large. Competitively, I don't worry about like a widespread number of other firms aggressively getting into our space. I worry about people who get into the space of really, really thoughtful and holistic advertising in a way that is not honest and ethical. Like, I think that we see people who do a type of media and get into this space, and some of them really do a good job and are honest brokers for clients, and some of them, I don't know the right word, maybe it's huckster, you know, they're selling a thing they really shouldn't be selling. In terms of the challenge we face, how we view things is fragmented. Issues like fake news and like deep fake videos and photos and stuff like that. I think in the political space, it's particularly dangerous. The way our minds operate in the political space is it's even more emotional and even more likely to sort of take rash action than maybe in some other spaces of our lives. So the potential for, you know, really, really bad things to happen. We talk about this while there's a sort of the mix of public health and politics right now with the potential of like a global pandemic. Like, that's a thing that worries me, right? If somebody says something that's not true, it can spread like wildfire.
Even faster than the virus itself.
Right. Much faster than the virus exactly. itself, right? So the president of the United States is a unique person and challenge, because I think before he was president, very few people felt like the landscape that exists and the ability to tap into misinformation and fake news, people felt constrained, for better or for worse, depending on where you stand. Like, he's sort of unconstrained in using it to deliver a message and sort of help himself win. So I think those are a couple of things that strike me.
Yeah, and I think that what we're seeing now with these companies, these, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Google, their reactions to try to show that they're policing themselves, they've thought through that in a way that doesn't hurt their bottom line and unfortunately doesn't really solve the problem that it's supposed to be solving, that they're just like nibbling around the edges and looking like they're taking action. So we need real political courage to hold these companies accountable, and that's what scares me in terms of the reality of what we know about how these platforms work.
Not only political courage, but moral courage.
Mm-hmm.
For those of us who are on the platforms, it requires us to be mindful and intentional in a positive way, hopefully, to be influencing our audiences.
I do think this is an important sort of entrepreneur and sort of startup idea. The ability to sort of make and build a successful company, obviously it's very admirable. To do it in a way that you have a really clear sort of set of ethics and moral compass, I think is really, really important. I saw a video with Sacha Baron Cohen recently of Mark Zuckerberg. He said, you know, like, imagine that Hitler were around today. Basically, your policy at Facebook is you would let his words be distributed all over the world with very little filter. And how dangerous that would have been during World War II. Obviously, he was taking that argument to its sort of furthest logical extent. But I do think it's an important point to say, you are creating policies and allowing for hateful speech and misinformation. And like, what is your guiding sort of principles? And right now, I don't think they're getting it right. It feels like a dangerous thing for democracy and society at large, as the institutions that we all need to trust. You know, I think certainly institutions have some of their own problems of building back up trust. But when you think about government, when you think about social organizations, when you think about a lot of different institutions, social media and some of these companies, if they allow misinformation and disinformation, it allows for the breakdown of institutions, which I think long-term is a danger for society at large and for businesses. You know, we depend on institutions and the parameters and rules and of the road for a marketplace. And if people don't trust those things, we're all worse off for it.
Yeah, and we'll get off our soapbox here in a minute, but...
I say stay on it, my friends.
The thing that a lot of people don't realize about how tied Facebook is to our democracy, like the actual, like getting on that debate stage as a Democratic candidate for president, the requirements were that you raised a certain number of donations, had a certain number of donors. At a practical level, the best and most cost-effective way for all of those people to get on that stage was to spend millions of dollars on Facebook. And so how dependent you are on their advertising platform to put you on that stage and then be able to hopefully get elected to try to police them too is really interesting.
I just wanted to bring up really quick, did you guys see like Mike Bloomberg's attempt to like get to younger people through purchasing, I think it was like the majority of 500,000 to whatever plus follower like meme pages asking them to post ads of him for money. And it was like the weirdest like kind of otherworldly thing that I was like, what is this election? Like, what is going on? And I just want to ask, like, how do you think advertising tactics are going to change? Not technology per se or platforms or mediums, but the tactics. How do you see them in 2, 5, 10, whatever years?
Great question. I think that also gets at this question of authenticity, right? That when you see that Bloomberg ad, I don't know that that's good money to spend if it looks so inauthentic. I don't know, Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. Your question is a good one, but it also is like, how likely is it that people like Michael Bloomberg with his means will run for president again?
Means, not memes.
Yeah, with his means, with his money, his wealth. When you look across the advertising space, oftentimes what we'll do for somebody, you know, rarely do folks spend everything they could on advertising, which makes sense. Very few people have unlimited funds. And like, as we look at his daily spend and his weekly spend on TV, on digital, on asking influencers to, paying influencers to post his content, buying pages. He is, for many practical purposes, spending every dollar that we could probably imagine and come up with as advertisers. But I completely agree with Amanda's point. I think that especially younger people who engage with social media in a more fragmented media environment more, I call it like people's like bullshit meter, you know, they can tell when somebody's inauthentic. And you know, went on to a debate stage with the other candidates and like he did not do well. So I think that his rise has shown the potential value in all of the advertising and all of the sort of paid content in all of the different places. But I do think there are limits to it, which is really good to see. I mean,
we don't take that. Do you know what I mean? We're like, no.
Right.
This is inauthentic.
That's right. And I think it goes to both brands and people, right? Like, if you're not the real deal, people figure it out. You know, like, we are a generation that uses, you know, Google reviews and Amazon reviews and Yelp and all these other things. And if a product or service or a place doesn't sort of meet the standard, we're not going to go there. And it shows the possibility of advertising when you spend that amount of money, but it also shows the limits when the product maybe isn't good enough.
And alternately, too, Michael Bloomberg, to his credit, has been able to use his money to fuel the very real, legitimate final like pushback on the NRA that has been incredibly valuable, like, you know, a movement of the majority of Americans who are very against proliferation of unfettered
gun
policy.
Did not know that. Wow.
Yeah.
He's the main funder of Every Town and Moms Demand Action.
Really? Mm-hmm. I did not know that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only thing I saw of him was literally like the meme pages. Mm-hmm. And then his like every single one had the same format, which was also odd. Like, I don't think that the people knew what they were doing. And then every comment, like you were saying, like pushback, it was like, what the hell is this? Like, why did he think this was a good idea at all?
Right. Sounds like he should spend more time letting people know what he's done.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Wanted to add one thing on that point. So I follow this page on Instagram called Tank's Good News. It's by this guy named Tank Sinatra. And it's an Instagram page which is not about Michael Bloomberg at all. It's just a bunch of nice stories. You know, Jimmy Carter building houses. It's people around the world helping one another. And the Bloomberg campaign paid him, he has 2.3 million personal followers, and his other page has 1.3, to post a meme about him and Michael Bloomberg. And his personal page, which I didn't follow, is now private. because I think he was getting so much pushback. So it's a good example of what you're what you're talking about.
Yeah. Bloomberg is an interesting case because I mean we have mutual friends, and those there's a cadre of
Bloomberg.
No, we, as in our guests today. But no, I would love some mutual friends of Bloomberg. They can fill my coffers any day for, no.
Might be able to buy you a studio.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, hey, Bloomberg, endorsement here. We have friends who have been hired by this campaign. And, you know, it's very tempting. He's done some really interesting things by saying, come on board. We're going to, whether we win or lose, I'm going to pay you till the end of the year. And politics, that's unheard of, right? If a campaign ends, that's the end of your contract. You're jumping on board to another. That's just the cycle.
Yeah, here's what I'll say about that. I mean, I think his commitment to paying people that he hires through November, through December even, I'm not sure, in the interest of beating Trump no matter what, is incredibly admirable. But I think what it also has shown is that there is just such a lack of young people who know that campaigns are an opportunity, that this is like a place to work, to get a job, and that there are so many jobs available right now to manage state house campaigns, manage local, you know, statewide, all kinds of races in Michigan and around the country. And I think that they are an incredibly valuable opportunity, a great first job, and a career path. You know, I think it's very kind of unknown. But to me, you know, campaigns are kind of like startups. You know, yeah. You have to get them up and going. You have to hire really quickly. They're very purpose driven. We're trying to win the election. We're trying to raise this money. We're going to spend it. And I think that's really exciting. And I think that so many people that I've known who've worked on campaigns and then gone on to do something else, it's just a really, really great thing to do that really prepares you for a lot of other opportunities, builds a network. So that's my plug for working on campaigns. Tons of jobs available right now.
And it's fun.
It's really, really fun. Yeah, and like, you know, you just dedicate 16 hours a day.
You'll never work harder in your life.
You'll never work harder in your life, but it's so worth it. And
I think it was a really great pitch until you said that.
Yeah. Meritocracy, too. It's all about, you know, who works the hardest. I think that was the lesson that I learned when I was 20 years old working for Senator Stabenow's.
Because you guys were talking about, you know, raising money and funding. If I remember correctly from my high school government class, they stated that in the past, whoever raised the most money or had the most money would generally win the race. But with how we use media today, do you think that narrative has kind of changed and, you know, you don't necessarily have to raise the most funds in order to win?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of research that's been done in that area of correlations between dollars raised and election outcomes. You know, with our campaign finance system, broken campaign finance system, there's so much that can be done to influence voters that is not the actual dollars raised by a candidate. So yes, that's not necessarily always true with the presidential election. I think like the Obama campaign was the first $1 billion campaign in America. And of course they were successful. But I think what we also spend time looking at is earned media, the like press coverage, what impact does that have, you know, and what kind of value can you put on a earned media story versus paid advertising, and that there are some tools that we use that do help measure that. But generally, I think of fundraising also as an exercise in organizing, that if you're getting someone to write you a $25 check, send you, you know, $5 with Apple Pay, that they're invested in your campaign if they're going to do something else and that they're talking in their social network about your candidate. So I think it's an incredibly valuable thing to do in today's day and age. A campaign that has raised $100,000 with $25 average donations versus a campaign that has raised $100,000 with $10,000 PAC donations is probably going to be more successful.
I would add this caveat too. While the way you framed your question is sometimes true, I think that generally, the folks who raise more win, but it is not always the case. I think one thing that we see, and I think this is especially hard here in the Lansing area and the people who we have personal relationships with but don't work with day to day, who we think are really smart on policy or have the right values, is sometimes people will say like, well, you know, money is corrupting, so I'm not going to raise money. And it's like, well, if you're a politician or an aspiring politician, that's not the answer. But to Amanda's point, I think this presidential race is a really good indication and sort of theory of the case in terms of the way you asked your question. Bernie Sanders is raising enough money. You know, there are days when he'll raise $1 million or $2 million But he is getting outspent by Michael Bloomberg, you know, 3 or 4 to 1 in most places. And he is sort of leading in the national polls. And so can you go without raising money? No. But some people still think that, and that's hard, especially when you really like them. But social media, like online and grassroots organizing and small dollar donations, they can be a great equalizer to Amanda's point. We're seeing that a little bit in the primary right now.
I have a really love-hate relationship with fundraising. In the purest notion, I'm not going to take money from a super PAC. I'm not going to do, like, many of friends of mine who have been progressive purists in that way. I mean, I respect that position, but I also go, but you can't change policy until you're in the position. And so it's not like the other side is not going to leverage, whoever your opponent is not going to leverage those dollars. And it's a great intention. It also doesn't necessarily work in practice. Not the way the current system is set up. And exactly, it is broken. It is a broken system. And so
the system is undoubtedly broken. If you look across advanced countries across the world, from, you know, South Korea and Japan to Western Europe, the ability to spend money in politics is highly limited in most places. Some places it's outright banned or heavily restricted. With some Supreme Court rulings, there are some limits on what can be done, but there are some really, really innovative ideas out there. You know, you guys talk a lot about entrepreneurship, and one area that you probably don't get into a lot, but campaign finance is a really interesting one, is for people who love to talk about ideas and come up with new ideas. There are a lot of really innovative and interesting ideas out there. So I call them like policy entrepreneurs, people who come up with good ideas that can be made into good public policy later on within sort of the restrictions of our system. And there are definitely ways to fix it. And it does seem like democracy reforms and campaign finance reforms, why they play so well in political campaigns is that it seems like you have to fix that stuff before you can begin to fix these other big problems.
You have a wonderful agency. And I want to know, how do you bake into your agency's culture the values that inspired you to begin the agency? And how would you tell aspiring entrepreneurs to do that, especially when you're bootstrapping it?
So Amanda can probably give some specifics about what we do as leaders and how we come back to our values. But I think the first thing is hiring and sort of training great people is the most important thing. We have an exceptional team. I would say we are pretty good at stuff, and our team is really, really great at stuff. And for the most part, there are a set of shared values about the work that we do, about how we work, about how we treat each other, that are really, really critical to what we do. So I think team is just so important when you're trying to build culture, maintain culture, and think about the vision and the sort of ethic that you all abide by.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, how we present ourselves in our, like, hiring process of bringing on new team members who definitely share our values and our priorities in the hiring process is important. You know, just on the wall we have our CMG values, and I think prioritize progress is the first one, but that there's a lot about teamwork and helping others on the team, and at the same time a culture of also, like, go figure it out if you don't know how to do it, that there's, you know, a lot of great resources out there to get things done. So just talking about those CMG values in the hiring process, in the orientation process, in our quarterly staff meetings, and the work that we do also just kind of on a daily basis, however we're reflecting on what a client is trying to get done, just reinforces that.
And I think what we said are sort of the main things that we think about, but as you get bigger and as you have larger clients and as you're thinking about sort of higher level things, it is a difficult thing to continue to think about the cultural norms that you want to live by. I mean, one of them is we like to give people a high level of autonomy and try things and fail and figure it out. As you can imagine, in advertising and creative work, it's a really tough sort of balance of how do you really keep quality high? How do you do a fantastic job? And how do you give people that autonomy to try things and fail and figure it out? And I think that striking that right balance, we don't always get it right, but I think trying to be thoughtful about it is something important for businesses of pretty much all sizes.
What did the beginning look like for you guys? What made you take that step and say, you know what, we're going to do our own thing. We're going to start our own business.
Ryan did it first. It was his idea.
Yeah.
I thought it was...
There's so much reservation in that scene.
You know, at that point, it seemed like the natural thing for you to do.
Yeah, I had a very good job and worked with some fantastic people. I wanted to do something important and something harder. You know, some days I'm like, you know, I could really use just sitting in one place for a little while and, you know, having that free time back. But Amanda mentioned earlier working on campaigns, their startups, and so I had built that muscle of building a few campaigns. But I also had started some businesses myself. I had a small retail business. My dad and I, growing up, had a sports memorabilia business. So to me, I had that muscle of trying things and failing or succeeding. And then Amanda, I think especially, you know, people from well-to-do or suburban communities or people with sort of resourced networks don't think about is the importance of funding up front. Amanda had a very good job at the point when I started the business. And so it gave us like the financial flexibility to, you know, I think we made like $4,000, $5,000 the first half of the year of the first year we did it, and then, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 the next year. I mean, the ability to have a financial runway to try things, fail, figure it out, really dive deep into the subject matter and get good at it, it's a luxury that very few people have when they start businesses, but it's an incredibly important one. I don't think financial flexibility can be sort of overlooked. And I think that's why in the entrepreneurship space, it's not as diverse as it should be. Diverse in terms of people of color, diverse in terms of women and men, diverse in terms of economic backgrounds. It is a great advantage to have a little bit of a financial runway to build a business. And I also think it's great that so many institutions and governments and nonprofits and incubators like try to seed businesses, but it is also a massive challenge in the entrepreneurship space to make sure that seed money is large enough and given to enough people at enough scale for them to really get off their feet.
Yeah, I think like growing up in Flint, the culture of Flint is that you grow up and get a job, like mm-hmm. not that you make a job mm-hmm. for yourself. For me, this was a little bit foreign, this idea of Ryan quitting a great job and starting a business, but I had a lot of confidence in him. And so then at the point that it made sense for us to work together and continue to build this really great big team, it did feel natural, but it also, we were kind of wondering, like, how long are we going to do this? But it's worked out really well.
It was a year and a half in that I asked Amanda to join the team because her skill set of networking and strategy were so critical, and it's not probably super common for the person you're married to be the perfect person to work with. I think in our case, it has been.
Do we get to go, aww?
You can. The other thing that I forgot to mention about myself that's probably a blind spot for me is my parents were both auto workers who used their time in the shop to get college degrees and then both eventually started their own businesses. My dad has a side business as a made computers, a software developer by day, and then made computers by night, and my mom started her own HR consulting business. So it's probably appropriate for me not to overlook that seeing that up close is a great advantage that I feel like I had.
I want to know about scaling. So I think that's really interesting in the startup space, knowing when to scale, when to grow. What did that process look like for you guys?
Oh, you're looking to me to answer.
What did it look like, and then what did it feel like?
Yeah.
Good question. So it's really, really important to critically look at the space that you're in.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so
sector.
Competitor. And also the way that your business functions. I think that the reason why you see so many incredibly wealthy people these days who are quite young is there is the potential, if you build something that is a platform or an app or a media company or artist or an athlete or a YouTube star, you have the ability to take the thing you do, scale it across the globe at low cost with relatively low overhead. If you build cars, you don't have the ability to do that right away. You have to have a very systemic plan for, you know, Tesla's actually implementing it as we speak, right? You have to build plants around the world. In our case, it's people-based. So all three of those different examples, the way you scale, how you scale, why you scale, are all sort of different questions and different answers. And so for us, in the agency business, it's who is your core client? How big is that market? How big could you get? And then thinking about all the processes that go into that and the path for growth. We have had, I think, a great deal of help from our team, from mentors we work with, from other businesses we work with, and then some business coaches over time in helping answer the question, what do you want to do? How big do you want to be to best accomplish that goal?
Who's your target customer?
Who's your target customer? How big is the market? And sort of having good expectations there, you know? So like for us, we know that our goal is not to be an agency that's 200 people with $100 million a year in revenue. Our goal is to be a really great agency, which staff-wise could be a little bit smaller, a little bit bigger than we are now, who's really, really focused on our sort of core service and our craft.
I just wrote down, how big can you get? And then how big do you want to get, right? Like, those are two very different things. Mm-hmm. They have a different impact on talent.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, Ryan and I have chosen to do this together, and we are also married. And so, you know, the importance of keeping this focused, sustainable, and, you know, that this is our personal life and our work life.
It's like growing a family.
Do you think those goals are something that you need to set at the very beginning, or do they, as the business grows, you kind of set them as you go?
We had a really good, over the last few months, we've had a really good discussion as a full team, and one is about who we are, what we do, what our core services are. I think that's a really important upfront question. A second thing we talk a lot about is building the systems to affect the outcomes for clients that we want to affect. I think those are two really important questions, because it's like, all right, what are we doing? How are we doing it? What are the day-to-day practices to make it happen? Those are really important questions to me, the question of where you're gonna go and exactly how you get there. I'm not sure that's worth spending quite as much time on, because it's what you hear like a lot of life coaches say, and sometimes it's good and sometimes people need that. But like, I could have never predicted the direction. I couldn't have predicted that creative and making really fantastic ads that can move and persuade people would have been a part of our business, but it's a very big part of our business. The ability to tell stories, it's a part of our business I never fully foresaw. So I think that I have some really great friends who they're good at the work they do, but they don't always have a vision for down the road. They're not always thinking down the road, and it allows them to sort of take opportunities as they come. And so I think it's certainly a balancing act, but I think that too much, like, I want to have a 300-person company and do this. I think that, one, that's putting the cart ahead of the horse, and it's probably not the right thing to focus on. And I think if you focus too much on where you want to go, you can miss opportunities that present themselves.
Mm-hmm. Like setting goals, the more short-term or like year-long goals over time, I think that's been helpful to us. But at the same time, that we kind of have like a number or goal in our heads, and then we shoot right through it. So, but at least like setting it is important to kind of have it in the forefront.
In a service business like ours, you know, in addition to whatever sort of public service goal or financial goal, quality is just such an important mm-hmm. part of our business and how you get future business. And so that balance of how aggressive you want to be in the number of people you help and really keeping quality high is a hard one, but that's oftentimes what we're thinking about in terms of our goals as well.
What is something during this conversation that we have not covered that you would like to chime in on?
There's this great story from the first weekend in, I think, the early 90s, when Warren Buffett and Bill Gates were introduced by Bill Gates Sr. And they were sitting around a table at some cottage in Washington State. And Bill Gates Sr. gave them each a piece of paper and he said, "Tell me why you've been successful." And they both wrote their answers down and folded it up and handed it to him. And the answer from both of them was focus. And I think that there is a lot more to business, to entrepreneurship, than focus. But I think that in this day and age, the ability to ignore your phone, the ability to ignore distraction, the ability to know generally what you want to do, to ignore sort of everything that comes your way, and the ability to focus in a really dogged way on the thing you do and get really, really, really good at that thing is probably underrated.
He loves that story. It's really a good one. Yeah, I really enjoyed being here and having this discussion. I don't know, you know, what else I have to say. I don't know. Do I have any stories that I like to tell? Like that one?
No, I will.
No, you don't.
I'm sure you have tons, but the thing that I think about you is the just the breadth and depth of Amanda's experience in communications, in politics, in relationship building, and networking. It is a great asset to all of us who work with her. And so I do think that finding people who to work with or to be your mentors who have that great deal of experience and depth to teach you is incredibly important for the success of any business that you start.
And I think specialization, I guess, too, in our business has meant a lot that Ryan and I have skill sets, and then we have amazing people who design and create things and make videos and do things that skills that we do not have. So I think that's a really great compliment to what we do.
This has been an infinite pleasure. Sincerely, I'm so happy to
thank
you
so much for having us.
Thank you.
It's been great.
You are Love Lansing treasures, and we are lucky, very lucky to have you in our community.
Thank you. Thanks. Very much. Thanks a lot.
We'll be back.
The Hatchcast is sponsored in part by Spartan Innovations. Spartan Innovations provides startups spinning out of MSU's ecosystem the commercialization support and financial resources necessary to turn MSU research technologies into successful Michigan businesses.
Hatchcast was created by me, Aaron Richard, and is produced by the Bridges Institute for Entrepreneurship in cooperation with the MSU Foundation. Gabe Hales is our editor and sound designer. Our co-producers and writers include Gabe Hales, Brandon Weaver, and myself. Original music and sound is created by Katya Gaudina, with help from Aubrey Haas, Brandon Weaver, Caitlin Setter, Sydney Owinga, Kurt Krieger, Tyler Mihai, Gabriella Allum, Jeff Smith, Paul Jakes, Ken Smuziak, Desiree Melfi, Neil Kane, and Lori Fisher. Thank you.